The dawn of time and the beginning of all things. Two forces, only good and evil. Then chaos. Time is born. Matter, space. The universe cries out like a newborn. The forces shatter as the universe explodes outward. Only echoes remain. Yet somehow, the evil survives. And intelligence, pure evil. I'm Chris Spivey.
And I'm Eddie Webb.
And today we're here to talk about The Curse of Finric. My favorite part about the quotes is I never know how exactly I want to do it until I start.
It just bubbles out of you.
And then I get to see your face, because in case people are curious, I have 8 screens basically. And Eddie's in one screen, but the other thing that I use for notes and the quotes are in another screen. So Eddie sees the side of my face while I'm reading, and I catch like glimpses of his face breaking down depending on how I do it.
I always imagine you're like Dr. Claw, and you have like all these different screens of people that you're watching and observing in different windows, petting a cat. Gadget.
I would have killed Gadget in the first 5 minutes, and then the series would be over.
No, because Penny is great, and Penny should carry the entire series by herself.
She can't, because she needs brain.
Aww. Brain is great.
There we go. That's our next series. It's going to be all about the Inspector Gadget. Not the movie with Matthew Broderick, but the cartoon from when we were kids.
Oh my God, I forgot about that until you just mentioned it. Now it's all flooding back.
Yeah, I wish I could forget about it.
Yeah.
So we're here to talk about what I think is one of the best episodes of Doctor Who, even though it's somewhat overstuffed for the small container it's in.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it is extremely ambitious, and it's not surprising that a lot of the Doctor Who spinoff stuff of the 90s is more or less endless riffing off of this episode. Season 26 as a whole, but this episode specifically.
This would be the foundation, what became New Who. Well, I'm sorry, became New Old Who and potentially New Who. Right.
New. There's so many Who's. New York.
Because Curse of Finric is sort of the final piece in a series of other pieces throughout the seasons that lead up to here, from like Ace's story sort of collides here. You get pieces of it with Lady Penerfolk, whatever her name was, Lady Penny Lane, and her chessboard and everything else that the Doctor learns and does. I'm not going to go into too much details about it because it comes out through the story, but all of those elements lead up to here to show that there was supposedly a line of thought that goes all the way through as it was planned. And that is a very much a model that the newer versions of Who took for their series completely.
Right. And another thing that I don't think is enough credit for inspiring the new version of Doctor Who is this is one of the few times where it intentionally breaks off and avoids an obvious continuity nod, right? Because spoilers for the episode we're about to talk about, vampires are kind of the central villain. And there's been a thing about vampires, and there's a whole Time Lord war with vampires. And they could have very easily mapped all that onto this, but they didn't, because they said other kinds of vampires can exist. And just because we did a version of a vampire story in the past doesn't mean that therefore that determines every vampire story we can possibly do. That's something that New Who has learned, is that there's a time and a place for continuity, and continuity is useful. You throw it in, and if it's not useful, you leave it out. That's something that this show never really understood until about right here.
And for all the stick that we gave G&T, a lot of that for not making it vampires and not linking it to State of Decay was because J&T was adamantly against doing that.
Oh, I didn't know that part.
Which works out for the betterment of this episode. Because then you get the Hermivores, which I've listened to some other podcasts before, and they've complained about the Hermivores, but
what?
As someone that loves me a space vampire or a variant of vampire, even if it's a radiation mutated vampire from the far future, love it. The costume design could have been a little better, but it's also season 26 of Doctor Who.
Right. Given the budget they had, it was honestly a pretty good costume. And you're right. It is exactly the right percentage of weird. It's like, okay, they're not just vampires. They're irradiated mutant space vampires from the future that live underwater. And that is peak Doctor Who, right? It's just it's not just a creature living under the gas. It's a giant space crab living under the gas. That's what makes Doctor Who great, is like, it's just, what if we add one more notch of nonsense and stop there? Just don't go any further. Just one more notch.
And since we probably won't go into it a lot, specifically in the episode itself, but how they then make other vampires, and all the other vampires don't look the same as the ancient one because he's so old, but they have all the elongated nails and just a slightly creepy walk. And that is how they portray the vampires. Like, that's their budget level.
Yep.
And comical, but it works.
Right. Whereas with Battlefield, we talked about how basically all the budget went into the destroyer. And that was kind of a joke. But also, that was the right call, right? It's like, listen, we have tons of Arthurian shit just hanging around the BBC claws. Let's just drag those out. Let's drag out the unit uniforms, get some military uniforms, slap a sticker on, or military vehicles, slap a sticker on it, call it a day, and then put all our money in this one place. That was the right call. Same thing here. It's like, again, go to the costume closet, get all the World War II costuming out. We'll go film in the middle of fucking nowhere, England, do all this stuff, and put our money into a reasonably large cast of vampires. I mean, because it's yes, the costumes are a bit wobbly, but also they have maybe a dozen people in costume, which is a high amount. I mean, from a show that has three ice warriors that constantly show up on screen different ways to make them look bigger, or that one Dalek model that survived from the 60s, they have to roll across the screen four or five times, you know. A reasonably large cast of extras is actually a pretty big expense. And on top of the fact, there's also a lot of the Russian soldier extras too. So I assume that some of those guys in Russian uniforms probably were also hemivores in other costumes. But the point is that they made this look big in a way that didn't, that frankly Battlefield failed on. Battlefield tried to make this big unit military force, and it broke apart pretty fast. And so they just tried to reduce as much as possible. And same, the big, huge army of knights that kind of them. This is different in that it's a smaller scale. And so the amount of people they had as extras stretched further and looked better. So, yeah, I mean, we found a show that's finally figured out how to use the minimal budget well. Well, that's not true. There are other eras in the show where they use minimal budget very well. This is the newest iteration of, after the recent amount of cuts, they've figured out a way to use that budget well. And it's combined with really good writing. And again, it's edited to the bone. I mean, there's no fat on the script because Andrew Cartmell can't figure out how to gauge a script to save his life. But again, it's to this episode's benefit because it just clips along. It's like, it is, I watched the Tales of Tartarus version, and it's an hour, it's 100 minutes around there. It's movie length. And it feels like a 45-minute New Who episode. That's how well-paced it is. Like, you forget how time flies. It's so well done.
And your comment about the sets, though, is that originally J&T wanted to have the show shot how all the rest of it was. I can't remember if it was Briggs or Cartmell convinced him otherwise. And so they shot on location. Mm-hmm. So that's why it actually feels different. And I think it feels more like a movie when you watch it than a lot of the other serials have that we've seen. And that adds to that sort of greatness of it. And given the period piece that it is, also, it was moved out of the original filming order, if I remember right, too, because it was supposed to have been filmed before some of the other ones. That's why McCoy was sort of in that big overcoat to reveal the new coat and costume.
Oh, right. Yeah.
But we'd already seen it because it shifted around.
That's right. Yeah. Because I forgot about that. You're right. The brown coat was supposed to be the kind of big reveal. And then it got showed up like right before the show pretty much got canceled. They shuffled the order around, which has led to an interesting fan theory, is that there is apparently a preferred watching order to better use Ace's arc. And like there's a certain way to shuffle, particularly season 26, a little bit of season 25, to shuffle those viewings around to get a better progression of the arc. I've not tried it myself. But honestly, I'm a little suspicious because I don't think there's enough connective tissue between these that needs a reordering. It's not like The Prisoner where there's explicit references that contradict each other if you watch the broadcast order, you know?
Right now, the only thing I could think of is that I would, and this is an iffy one, would potentially shift the Curse of Fenric to start season 26.
I mean, yeah, and that's what comes down to is like there's thematic vibes. Like one of the ones I think I remember is like Fenric starts season 26, and it really it becomes kind of more of a capstone for season 25 in the sense of the idea of watches of a unit, right? But like that's kind of the end of the Doctor planning against the powers of the universe arc, and the beginning of Ace's actual progression, which started during that, but now it just kicks in the gear. And then we move into Battlefield, whereas Ace tries to, and watching that perspective, Ace is now recovering her trust of the Doctor that was damaged in this. And then Ghostlight goes after this because that's where Doctor's recovering from her damaged trust. Battlefield after that, and then Survival at the end. And there's, and like I said, you can make arguments for it, but again, it's just vibes, honestly. There's nothing wrong with watching season 26 in this order. That's the order I watched it in.
Now I'm thinking, now since I've heard you speak more, my ideal order, because I remember something specifically from this episode now, is I would go Ghostlight first, then Curse of Fenric, Battlefield Survival. Because Ace references an old mansion that is creepy.
Yes.
Specifically in this episode. And so that would have let people see it beforehand instead of making it a past event. And I think for this episode, they kind of even changed it and made it not Ghostlight unless you know about Ghostlight. Right. But it loses some of the strength and resonance of that because Ghostlight is another phenomenal Ace character development episode. Right. And coming to here, you've already seen the episode, I don't care now. But when Ace dives in the water, that would have sort of fulfilled some of her moving away from the trauma that she had from that house and her mother.
Right, and her diving into the water from this plays better if it's somehow before Battlefield, because then her coming out of the water in Battlefield then resonates nicely with this, whereas this way, the reverse way, it kind of looks a little wonky. So yeah, I mean, I'm not saying I can't see the merits of it. I'm just saying is it's not nearly as, like, watching The Prisoner in broadcast order is hard for the first time because it doesn't make sense, and you can argue that's part of the show and it works on that level. But if you do reorder the episodes, it actually makes for a better viewing experience on some level. Whereas with this, it's more just trying to do some editing to smooth out the rough spots of what is otherwise a phenomenal season. And so like, I see the instinct for it and I can see the argument for it, but it's, I don't think it's as strictly necessary as some people maybe believe it to be.
And although I personally love Ghostlight, I do not think you could start your season with Ghostlight.
Right. Right. But I've also seen stuff like Remembrance of Daleks moving later just to kind of get some connection between get resident Remembrance of Daleks closer to Curse of Fenric. And I'm like, because to keep that kind of the war against the ancients vibe going. Mm. And so you get kind of, I think the idea is you want to get kind of a Remembrance of Daleks, Silver Nemesis, and then Curse of Fenric close to each other. So you can get kind of a bam, bam, bam fight against the ancients thing going. But I do feel like spacing it out a bit more gives Ace room to breathe. And so I think there's value in the Doctor's plan not being this ongoing onslaught of plot, but rather something that happens in the margins of Ace's story. So, I mean, it becomes preferred viewing order at that point in time. People have their own kind of way of doing it. I personally love reordering media. I find that sometimes you get some interesting resonance by doing things like in chronological rather than publication order, or some MCU viewing orders of like how you do it. Like I love the machete order of Star Wars, where you watch Star Wars 4, then you go back to watch episodes 2 and 3 is kind of a very long flashback. 4, 5, and 6. I actually find that to be a fun experience. But again, Doctor Who fans being of a certain ilk, there's a lot of, no, this is the definitive way. This is the way that Andrew Cartmel planned it. It's like, no. Andrew Cartmel, like all television, was just trying to commission scripts, was trying to do a light amount of continuity inside of a season rather than just generic, the show has continuity. And it didn't quite work out for production purposes, and so he tried to make it work the best he could.
Yeah. Given that one of the things they're potentially were going to do is make this into 5 episodes. Right. And Briggs was like, no, you can't. It would like disrupt the flow of it. It would shatter everything. And he didn't feel there was enough for that 5th episode.
And I think it's a good call.
And we on this podcast know that Eddie likes long runs of Doctor Who where very little happens per episode.
It's amazing. It's the best thing ever.
And I agree. It was their better call to have 4 packed episodes instead of 5 languid episodes.
I mean, you're joking about this, but also I know you are a huge fan of the War Games, so you are not completely immune to this.
I like the War Games. It is a mess, and I love it. Every moment of that 10-episode serial, I love.
It's an experience.
Even when the Doctor doesn't show up for an entire one, or they run across the same battlefield 18 times. Oh,
Jamie just explains to him several times, no, this is not Earth, and he keeps getting confused about the exact same plot point several times.
Beautiful.
But Doctor, how can they have machine guns during the ancient times? Jamie, I fucking told you already, buddy.
Before we go into the synopsis proper, did you know that one of the few of the other working titles for this episode?
No,
for the Curse of Finarak. The Wolves of Finarak, that I kind of like.
Okay. Yeah.
And then there was one, it was either Time Wolf or Wolf Time. I think it was Time Wolf.
Oh, God.
You don't like Time Wolf? Time Come Wolf. On. It's like Time Cop, but Time Wolf.
Time Wolf sounds like something airbrushed on the side of someone's van.
It would be right next to Airwolf. I tell you, if we could find Airwolf, we'd be talking about it. Any
Would
other
we?
Comments?
Would we?
Any other comments before behind the screen stuff before we go to the synopsis? We love the Seventh Doctor, and we've talked a lot about him last time. And I don't know if there's anything you want to cover that we're missing.
The only other thing I can think of is this. We talked a bit about the novelizations and how weirdly important they are. And this is actually a really seminal one because this and Remnants of the Daleks both are the kind of preludes to the long-running New Adventures novelizations that happen during the Wilderness years, which maybe we'll talk about in a future time. So, I mean, I don't want to get too far into that now. But there was a lot of material that was cut from the scripts that was put in the novelization. But I agree, it wasn't worth a whole episode, partially because a lot of the stuff that was added in was just background material, like backstory to characters and also allusions to things that the series, by the time the novelization was written, they knew they would never pay off. So it's like, well, screw it. I'm just going to add some stuff in here because it'd be fun. And it got picked up. So like you mentioned the idea of the other being the third person along with Omega and Rassilon.
Love it. Love
it. That's in both, I think, Remembrance and Curse of Fenric, the idea that the Doctor has always fought, and again, there's a nod to the demons as kind of vaguely a start point from the Doctor starts going after these kind of ancient forces.
I'm sorry. Did you say the demons or the daemons?
Sorry, the daemons. My apologies. The Matt Daemons. So, I mean, this is a point where the novelizations of stories end up making continuity that televised Doctor Who actually at least thematically acknowledges and sometimes explicitly acknowledges comes up around books like this. So it's fascinating because like there are some things that people are so familiar with the novelizations and then they get surprised when they rewatch the TV show and say, oh, that wasn't in there, right? I know when I read the novelization of this, because this is one of the few novelizations they had in my library. And then when I rewatched the show like years later, I'm like, oh, there's whole scenes that like are just missing. Like the relationship with Ace and her Russian boyfriend makes way more sense in the novelization than it does on screen.
Yeah, because some of that, the TV cut because they didn't think it was appropriate because they were trying to make it a family television show.
Right.
And that's when you learn out about Ace and Sabalon Glitz. Ugh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I forgot about the heavily implied sexual assault that happened in the novelizations.
And they were also, Judson, in case people can't put the linkage together, was sort of a nod towards Alan Turing. And originally, something they wanted was to have Judson and Millington having been in a relationship together. And Millington is the reason that Judson's in a wheelchair because he caught him flirting or looking at some other guy. But they had to remove all that other subtext from it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which then makes Millington and Judson's relationship make so much more sense.
Right. Yeah. That's one of the weird, we're talking about how much we love season 26. Some of that does come from admittedly fan knowledge of gaps that are filled in. But I continually argue that I think Doctor Who is best when there are plenty of gaps for the audience to fill in. Because if too much is explained about Doctor Who just becomes boring, just becomes a dude doing stuff. But if there's always a mystery and Cartmell's mission was to make the Doctor mysterious again, he absolutely succeeds in this season. And then the novelizations come along and they start to fill in some of the gaps. It adds more because it's like, oh, okay. And it helps you to appreciate the stories better. But I still maintain that these stories are good on their own because even if the screen couldn't show that there was a relationship between the two of those guys, you see enough of the chemistry on screen to kind of get what's actually happening there, right? Yeah. The actors are aware of the context enough to put it in their performance to be able to make sure that we're seeing it more in retrospect, but certainly that there was something there that doesn't need to be all spelled on the screen. That's actually, again, one of the reasons why I think Ghostlight struggles a bit is because it's cut too much, and so some of that frisson is ends up being missing, and so you actually do lose that connective tissue in a way that these other episodes don't have, even though they're cut just as hard, because there's just enough left of the connecting pieces to fill in the gaps yourself if you're a smart and attentive watcher.
I'm waiting now for someone to add us and say, I went and watched Ghostlight because you two would not stop talking about it and you didn't cover it, and I loved it.
I'm not mad about Ghostlight. I mean, it has the best caveman butler of television.
Okay. Part one. During World War II, Soviet soldiers arrive at Maiden's Point on England's Northumberland coast, but one got lost. Nearby, the TARDIS materializes. The Doctor and Ace step out, Ace in period clothing. The Doctor claims this is a top-secret naval installation. Ace scoffs, saying that if it was, of course they should have been stopped by now. And indeed, a few steps later, they're confronted by armed guards. The Doctor tricks the guards by complaining that it took them too long to find them, insulting their discipline and their shoes. And then he asks where Dr. Judson's office is. In Judson's office, the Doctor ingratiates himself by recognizing the prisoner's dilemma, and Ace does so also by recognizing the logic game that Judson has mapped out. The Doctor quickly forges an authorization letter, which the nurse watches him do before the guard arrives and hands it to the guard to show they should be there. The Soviets discover the sole survivor of their missing troops. He is delirious and pale. Captain Sorn grills him about the orders. Where are the orders? But he can't answer. Another isolated soldier further away finds the orders, and inside, a photograph of Judson before he's killed by something in the water. And that's where I pause.
Dun, dun, dun. So, Chris, did you do what we talked about off air and watch the aired version of this?
I watched whatever was on Amazon Prime because I, as always, had no time and I watched it last night at 7 o'clock.
Fair enough. So, season 26, I think one of the reasons... Because it's so beloved, there are a wide arrays of you can watch these. So like even before Tales of the TARDIS, there's a lot of omnibus versions of this. The VHS version, which adds some footage in and reorders some footage. They usually have the original broadcast version. Some of them also have additional. But for First of Fenris, they do have the original broadcast versions with the original broadcast subtitles for the Soviet soldiers. and the font they chose is the most horrible.
Wait, was that the matrix. Huge block? Yes, that's on Amazon Prime.
Oh, that's when you actually got that one? Oh, yeah. Wow. Okay. I figured they would have used the updated version where they just used normal subtitles from the subtitle.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because it bad. Looks starkly really different.
Yeah. And it covers like half the screen. It's just awful.
I love a historical Doctor Who. I do.
Yeah.
Because as someone that likes to write historical fiction, seeing a show that gives me historical fiction is always so much fun. And one of the things for me, though, as a creative, is that when I do historical fiction, I don't want it all to be different. I want like one thing, maybe two things, to be a different starting point, and that sort of alters the rest of the history around it to compensate. Mm-hmm. So it has more of a ripple effect and just like everything's different. Go forth. Then it becomes less history and more fiction. It's a fine line. And Doctor Who, when done right, pulls it off perfectly.
Yeah. And I mean, this is technically alternative fiction because it's a different organization, but it's very clearly meant to be Bletchley Park. So like it's that's your one change, right? I mean, well, besides undead space vampires, but you know, it's yeah, they still a strong female staff. That's very yep. accurate to Bletchley Park. A eccentric.
Hey, Eddie. I'm an American. What's Bletchley Park?
Look it up. No. Bletchley Park. Honestly, if you watch this episode, you pretty much know what Bletchley Park is. They were a group of codecrackers in World War II, led by Alan Turing, who was notoriously, literally, homosexual. He got arrested for it. But also was a pioneer in computer technology, much like the characters we see here. Dr. Judson is basically working on, what they call it, the Enigma machine in this?
Ultima machine.
Ultima machine, okay. But it's a parallel of an existing technology, although obviously not as advanced or possessed by demons. But, you know, it's meant to be, let's do the exact same thing but change the names. Which, on the one hand, is frustrating because it's like, why didn't you just use Alan Turing? And the answer is, because that's British television in the 80s. They couldn't do what they wanted to do with it.
Yeah. They, reading some of the stuff, literally the reason they couldn't use it is because they couldn't talk about the sexuality of the character.
Right. But things like high-ranking British officers having a mock-up of Nazi offices, trying to get to the mindset of the Nazis, that was a real thing. Women primarily running this code-breaking institution because it was a place that women could contribute to the war effort because all the men were needed to fight overseas was a real thing. And the complications that resulted from that, particularly women with children, were all real concerns. So even though this is a entirely fictionalized effort, a lot of attention was paid to English contributions to World War II in this very specific thing. So like, it feels very authentic because it's largely is authentic. Obviously liberties taken even beyond the supernatural things, there are liberties taken from a storytelling standpoint. But this is ultimately more or less our understanding of Bletchley Park.
And that does remind me that I think something that we should cover that I'm going to put out now is Bletchley Circle first season. It's better than second season. And Foyle's War. We started Foyle's War. So we're going to take a slight deviation because it's what I do. Foyle's War sort of happens in England during World War II. And it's about a police officer and the two people working with him. And it's all solving crimes during the war based in England. Okay. So it's a historical piece, very well acted. And it ran for 8 years, like around 2000 when it started. Bletchley Circle is about the women who were code breakers post the war.
Right. It was after the war. They were trying, you know, they were trying to use it for other purposes. Yes. I've heard of both of them. I've not watched either of them. So
watched all of Bletchley Circle and currently watching Foyle's War. I like them both. So for listeners, that may be coming up sometime in the future, unless Eddie and I say, that's it. We've done this long enough. It's been 2.5 to 3 long years.
I mean, if you want to do wartime dramas and are willing to extend the war, there is one called Rebellion that was on Netflix for a while. It's an Irish show. It's First World War, but ooh, it's the Irish uprising in Dublin during the 1920s.
Yeah, all right. I'll have fun. Check that out.
Yeah.
Okay. We're not here to talk about our future programming. Other than this is literally what a conversation with Eddie and I are like.
Yeah, if you ever find this together, it's us going, you should check this out. Oh yeah, you should check it out. That'd be awesome.
No, I lost where I was. So it was. I loved the fact that the nurse watches the doctor forge the letter and sign them and says yes. Nothing, and it shows her watching him. So he's not tricking her to then give them that letter.
It's honestly, I have always felt this scene is kind of the last gasp of the doctor bambles his way into things before psychic paper, right? It's like, this is a scene. It's like a proto psychic paper. We know the doctor's going to bluff his way into things. We don't need to see all the ramifications of that. Let's just have him do it and insinuate himself into the character so we can start the conversation and get to the good part. And so this is kind of a comedic nod towards that. But the next logical step is he just has a magical thing that allows him to present whatever identification he needs to get into the place he wants to get into. So this is basically that moment just done slightly funnier. And I think it's glorious, especially the bit where he switches his hands to sign. it's so great.
One of the cut beats from this, though, I don't know if it was filmed or is this in one of the different scripts, is that the nurse was going to be a Soviet spy.
Oh, okay.
So that even reinforces her seeing him do that. She wouldn't have said anything.
Right.
But without that, it just becomes a comic beat, how you're saying. It still works. But either way, love it. And it's so weird. And it's just.
And we also see, arguably for the first time, I have to go double check that it may have happened in a previous episode I'm not thinking of, where we see a companion expressing expertise outside of their one notes. This is the thing the companion does. Because so much of Doctor Who is a companion does a thing, and if they're lucky, they get to do their thing. But if they're unlucky, they get to just be peril monkey bait. And so Leela is good at fighting. And so if the fighting thing happens, she gets to fight. Sarah Jane's good at investigating things. So if an investigation thing happens, she gets to investigate. Ace
Mel's does a good lot at screaming.
Mel's good at screaming and allegedly computer programming, which... It took only 30 plus years for that to actually come up in television.
You know what, though? I am happy that they brought Mel back to be part of the show.
Yeah.
And so a lot of the casting is focused more on younger actors. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that they're bringing out older actors to continue to be awesome.
So this Ages is a digression. One of the things that I love about Doctor Who, and it's purely accidental, is because Doctor Who had a constant churn of young female companions and also a collective interest in continuity, you end up with a show that now has a massive amount of strong women of middle age or older doing cool shit. And so you now have a show where you could have an entire room full of amazing women doing cool stuff, like in the Doctor Who specials. And it's not weird or strange or forced, because these are all characters have strong historical reasons to be there, and they've proven themselves. And so you have the head of unit is a woman, and the lead programmer is a woman, and you have the scientific advisor is a woman, and it doesn't feel forced or shoehorned in. Yep. So it's come as a result of accidentally, but it doesn't change the fact that it's happened, and there are showrunners who are actively trying to leverage that. So yeah, we have episodes where Ace is still out there kicking ass, and that's not weird or unusual.
Or we have Leela on Gallifrey.
Yes.
Like doing her bit before she buggers off before the Dalek can kill her. Beautiful. Out there kicking butt to continue that fight. I love it.
Right. And even we're getting slightly, well, incredibly off topic, but the radio drama or the audio drama Gallifrey, which was basically originally was meant to be just a way to kind of use some Fourth Doctor companions that didn't have access to Tom Baker, and ends up being this amazing political drama that is entirely run by women, with one exception. There's one male character who's on the main cast, and he's basically kind of beat up for a lot of that first few seasons. So you have a lot of strong political women doing strong, cool things that, and their gender is only a small piece of that. And so to kind of bring it back around to this, we see that shift starting to happen because Ace gets to have her own several cool moments in Curse of Fenric, but it starts here where she basically does 80s computer engineering in a 40s setting. And I don't know about the British school system, but I know growing up around this time period that absolutely there was a strong push to try to get kids to learn computer science because they felt that was going to be the way of the future. They wanted to have kids prepared for, you know, the coming years to that where computers took over the world. And it turns out they were right, you know. So
STEAM programming.
Yeah.
STEM. Yeah. Not STEAM. STEM. I will point out though that it is the only reason that Judson likes Ace is when he realizes that Ace is also brilliant.
True, yeah.
And I like the beat though that she doesn't call it specifically what Judson would call it, but reference it as what supposedly Sophie Aldern is older than 18 or whatever Ace is supposed to be, but calls it like a flip floppy thing, but still conveys the knowledge that she has using the vocabulary that the character would have.
Right. I mean, weirdly, this exact beat was in Tomb of the Cybermen. Here's a logic puzzle that needs to be solved. In Tomb of the Cybermen, only the doctor and the male scientist could figure out the logic puzzle. Here, that beat is given to Ace, and there's no hedging around it. Doctors come in to give her advice, whatnot. She completely controls that beat of the story, and it turns out actually her doing that is a problem for the doctor's plan. But it doesn't change the fact that Ace gets into trouble by for being too smart. And that is just frankly a beat that you've almost never seen in classic Doctor Who. I think this is the first and only time it happens, but I could be wrong. There's a lot of Doctor, 600 plus episodes to go through. I'm sure I missed one, but it's rare.
The Soviet soldiers was interesting, I think, but I'm not sure how I still feel about that beat of it yet. I know they're crucial to the story as it evolves, but some of the plotting with them, something about it, even when I first watched it, bothers me. Something about it last night bothered me when I rewatched it. And I've seen this episode a lot of times. I can never quite put my finger on it. I think it's different things every time I watch it.
I feel the same way. My personal thought on it is that it is still late 80s, right? So Soviet Russia was still the enemy to the West. And so I think the idea was that also opinion on Soviets as bad guys was softening. And so I think the idea was we need to get the audience ready for the idea of sympathetic Soviet characters. So we have spent a lot of time really getting people okay with the idea of sympathetic Soviet characters because Soviets were allies with us during World War II. I have also, unrelated to this, I've been reading a biography of Stalin recently, and this is relevance to a beat that'll come up later, but this was a biography written about 10 or 20 years ago. They got access to a whole bunch of Stalin's letters, and so the idea was to show Stalin as a person. And again, it's this kind of, here's Stalin as a person juxtaposed by all the horrible shit he did. So what happens as a result of Curse of Fenric is it feels a bit like Soviet apologentia, right? It's not quite propaganda, but certainly implies that Soviets maybe weren't as all bad as all that. They were. They absolutely were. So it feels weird probably then and now. I think it's one of the things where it is not that it aged badly. I think that the resonance with it actually probably case was like, now that we're in the middle of a war with Ukraine, that vibe is now back to where it was roughly in the 80s, whereas there was a gap in the middle where the Soviet Union collapsed, and it's like, oh, that's so quaint. You know, we thought the Soviets were bad guys. I think we're kind of back to, okay, no, Russia has a propensity for doing horrible shit. So I think these are needed scenes to get the audience on board with the idea of why Abe should be sympathetic to a Soviet soldier.
Okay. Thank you. The following day, Reverend Wainwright speaks to Miss Harkner. That's what I'm calling her. If it's wrong, you're tough. And her two evacuee charges, Jean and Phyllis. Ace makes fast friends with the girls, and they'll meet at Maiden's Point later. Ace asks about all the silver in the church, and the vicar assures her that locals are too frightened of Viking curses, and the church is built on old Viking graves where evil was once said to be buried. The time travelers find Judson working on Viking inscriptions in the church crypt, and he's confident that the Ultima code machine can crack the inscriptions. Ace comments about hearing machinery, but the doctor dismisses it as sounds of a church organ. On the way to Maiden's Point, they notice the churchyard containing graves of the Vikings' descendants. The doctor and Ace find the open orders at Maiden Point and realize that there are Soviet soldiers about. The doctor returns to the church and warns Ace not to enter the water before he leaves. He convinces Wainwright to share his grandfather's translations about the Viking curse and treasures. They wish to return to the North Way, but the curse claims that their lives at Maiden's Bay. The doctor reads part of the Soviet orders that mentions Norway, the North Way, and takes the translations to Judson.
The Jean and Phyllis thing, I want to get to briefly. There's a resonance there that I didn't get for a long time, and I've only recently got this last time because of I live here now, which is the idea that there are very broadly speaking, two British cultures. There's London and everyone else. Mm-hmm. That's extremely reductive, and I recognize that. But there is a distrust of people who live in London and to some degree vice versa in England. And so Jean and Phyllis are explicitly and intentionally listed as London girls coming up, and they're evil, wicked London ways are ultimately what lead to their destruction. And so that is a bit that I didn't recognize because Ace's relationship with Jean and Phyllis feels weird if you don't maybe have that context. But one of the reasons why they're bonding is because they're all from London.
Okay.
So Jean and Phyllis are like, oh, here's someone else who understands us because nobody else here does. From Ace's perspective, it's just here are people who are at least somewhat from the same culture as me. And so that's why they bond so quickly. And then how that changes as we talk about later on, I'll bring it up again, but I want to put that in there. It's like there is this kind of London versus, let's say, the North dichotomy that occurs in English culture.
Is that why Christopher Elkinson was in that show, Your Friends from the North?
Yes. Right. And also why the, why you sound like you're from the North bit in season one, is because everyone else is from London, and so that's why that I get better. Why, I mean, the joke works fine, honestly, but I get a little more of the nuance of the joke now. This is there's an interesting dynamic that I didn't quite get several times I watched it previously, but now I live here in London, I've seen a bit more now.
Okay, even for me without that context, it still works because they're really the only youths in the episode.
Right.
So it sort of has that instant bonding, and having a daughter and seeing her go off and make friends, it's always awkward like that. And then later when it breaks down, sometimes relationships break down, it breaks down in a similar fashion.
Right.
Well, not the sea monsters come and get them, but I digress. So like there is a lot that goes on during that beat, that little paragraph bit that shows you how much is packed into this episode. It's like constantly moving. You're constantly meeting characters, and all of them are adding in pertinent small bits to go on. Even the woman who's taken both Jean and Phyllis in gives you a little bit about them and like where they come from, what you're talking about. Then we've get the vicar who knows all the translations and tells you that the town believes in Viking curses. A town of people at a military installation believe in Viking curses.
Right. And that's what's interesting about the next episode, right, is that because, again, there's this very broad stereotype of Northerners are all kind of superstitious yokels and people from down south / London are sophisticates. But, of course, the reverse is that people down south you know, are just a bunch of hedonistic idiots who don't understand how the real world works. And what's fascinating is that both stereotypes are true, but also both stereotypes are played with more nuance in this. So it's like, yes, this is a village of people who believe in Viking curses, but it turns out they have reason to believe in Viking curses because Viking curses are literally true. And, you know, the London sophisticates are dismissive of all of this, and that is to their literal peril.
Any other comments about this before we move on?
No, I think that's it.
At the base, Ace and the Doctor find the Women's Royal Navy Service are listening to coded transmissions. One of them, Kathleen Dudham, has a baby whom Ace likes but hates the baby's name, Audrey. It's the same name as Ace's mother, whom she hates. Millington orders the baby off the base in 24 hours or else. Millington's office is a perfect replica of a German cipher room in Berlin, where he tries to figure out the enemy's mind. With the only real differences are there's a picture of Judson and Millington together at school, along with a Viking-themed chess set. In his office, Judson continues to read the translations, telling of the gods' final battle at the world's end. As he reads, new runes appear, burning into the walls of the crypt, and a creature hiding behind a ruined Viking ship stirs. While searching Maiden's Point for more clues, Ace and the Doctor find the dead soldier's body, who saw the orders earlier, with a strange object in his hand. Then suddenly they are confronted by, at gunpoint, by Soviets who jump out of them. End episode. Dun, dun, dun.
I kind of want to emphasize, like, this is episode one. This is 25 minutes of television. And we have introduced, depending on how you count, somewhere between 8 to 12 supporting characters, all of which are named, have several lines, and have a plot arc and of some form in this story. We have introduced not only a World War II setting, but a Viking setting on top of it.
And a monster.
And a monster. This is some tight fucking television, man.
You feel a little tired watching it from how fast it's moving.
Yeah, and again, the movie is showing, like, this is one of the few Doctor Who serials that work really well in the edited together format, I think, because the cliffhangers are not so obviously cliffhangery, but they still work as individual episode cliffhangers, right? Like, oh no, they're surrounded by Soviet guns. That's great. We'll see how he gets out of it when we talk about the serial or the next episode. But the point is that it's a bit of tension that flows naturally as opposed to arbitrary cliffhanger inserted here, right? Of course, when you have a British naval base and British soldiers are there, there's going to be a conflict between them. It's a natural evolution of stakes. So it doesn't feel forced at all. It feels like, of course, it's going to be gunplay between the Soviets as they infiltrate.
Now, I'm not going to make a joke about the Doctor on an umbrella going down. Any other comments?
Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention, in the middle of all of this, also, by the way, the God's final battle world end, just thrown in there. Just, you know, no context. Well, just,
if you're translating Viking inscriptions, what else would it be about?
Right, exactly.
Did you get the point that Vikings are going to be important in this episode? Did you catch that yet?
A smidge. A little bit.
Part two. The Doctor or Ace are taken before Captain Soren. The Doctor warns against a full assault on the base, as it would be suicidal. Instead, he pleads to let them go investigate and find a way to stop the evil that is killing Soren's men. A delirious soldier holds a similar object to what the Doctor found on the beach, and the Doctor calms him by touching his forehead. Meanwhile, Nurse Crane forces Judson to stop deciphering the new inscriptions, as the crypt is too cold for him. Millington insists he use the Ultima to decode the inscriptions, even though it is needed for German interceptions. Returning to the crypt, the Doctor and Ace spot the new inscriptions. Remembering the machinery Ace heard earlier, they look for a secret door. However, Millington finds them first, taking them at gunpoint into the hidden passage connected to the church. Inside, men are mining toxins from the cavern walls, a chemical weapon to end the war. The Doctor tricks Millington into believing he's on his side. The Doctor goes with Millington to the Ultima machine. leaving Ace in the church talking to Wainwright. The vicar has lost his faith in humanity. At the Ultima, Millington reveals that the computer is bait for Soviets. Their plan is for them to break in and steal it, but inside the machine, there is a toxin that when it receives the right phrase, it will release it into the major city. He gives the doctor a demonstration by killing these poor little pigeons in a cage, and the doctor is horrified.
Right.
Did you know that originally it wasn't supposed to be a toxin in there? Do you know what it was supposed to have been?
What?
An atomic bomb. That was in one of the scripts. I wanted to see how Doctor Who would squeeze an atomic bomb into, first, the Ultima machine. Secondly, how are the Soviets going to steal that large Ultima machine? There's a squad. They're on a dinghy. Eddie, explain this to me.
Actually, I was just saying, like, it's clear that Millington got some plan advice from the master. Because when you actually think about this plan, it makes no fucking sense. So here we do, guys. We're going to invent a code machine. It's not a real code machine. Of course it works. I mean, it actually does what it's supposed to do. We're going to build a hire an entire staff of people. We're going to run it. It's going to absolutely crack codes. But its whole thing is a trap to get a bunch of Soviet soldiers to come over. No, we're not fighting the Soviets. We're allies with them. But they'll still want to come and take this machine. And then we're going to stick an atomic bomb slash toxins in it. But the toxins we mined from the mines underneath this place. Where do we get – how do you know them there? It just happened to be coincidence. But no, we have these toxins available. We're going to shove it inside the machine. It's like, okay, question. Why don't we just shoot a bomb of toxins at Russia? No. Too simple. This is way better.
Well, he specifically points out when the political climate is better. That's how they defeat all that.
Right. And it's just, I mean, it's the depth of strength that when you're watching it, this is very much refrigerator logic. You have to walk away and go, wait a minute. Because even when Millington's like, no, the Russians are not going to be allies for long. And that is a valid concern, right? Like, why the Russians are their allies is a very complicated geopolitical thing, but it's not because we're friends. It's because it is an alliance convenience. So it's not at all invalid to be like, some point they're enemies and we have to get a step ahead of them. It's just that when you actually sit down and break the plan down, it's like, why did you think this was going to work? The only reason why this worked is by sheer coincidence.
And it's – so you have the larger reason why it doesn't work. I am obsessed with the smaller details of it. For instance, like how are they going to transport this large machine off? And if they do get it back to Russia, are they not going to take it apart and see the obvious vial of toxin inside of the machine? Because they show us that it's a vial.
The first part they do explain a bit later than this is that it's the rotor. The rotor is locked up and the rotor is the key piece of the machine. So everything else apparently is just set dressing. And so the Soviets want to steal the rotor, and then from there they can rebuild the machine from the rotor somehow because reasons. And the vial would be inside the rotor. But you would think like the first thing they would do would be like, okay, is this bombed or otherwise trapped? Because that's what I would do if I was an evil Soviet spy. Oh, look, there's a trap here. Let's remove that vial of liquid that's glowing green and therefore probably not safe. Before we take the rest of the device with us.
Is this horse in fact a Trojan? Would be my first thought, but I don't know. I'm not a World War II soldier.
And also, I find it highly, highly unlikely that the extremely common word love does not show up in any other decryptions. The actor stumbled across a German code of someone just talking to his wife, and suddenly the whole thing blows up accidentally. I love you. God damn it. Why didn't we choose a more obscure code word?
It was nice to see the doctor trick Millington into thinking that he was on his side.
Yeah.
Showing once again, like, that this is a doctor that is more wily than some of the other ones.
Right. And as much as I'm making fun of this plan, the way Millington plays his line here about the love, we as the audience get pretty quickly, oh no, Millington's insane. And so the way I choose to view this episode with all of this is that Millington's plan was always bonkers. It was never going to work. and they accidentally actually managed to snag a Soviet team. It's just, it actually kind of worked. The Soviets are like, we have no idea. They had no idea how big this thing is. So it's like, yeah, there's a device here. Let's get Soren and some of his experimental people out there. Yeah, just go across the channel and try to steal this thing if you can. If not, we don't really care, but it'll be great if you can grab it. And Millington's like, I got it. This is my master plan. And it's like, no, buddy, you got like a bunch of scouts. But I mean, again, to the show's credit, like when Millington says, well, the word could it be? It's love. And the way he plays it, it's like, oh no, no, this is not a serious plan. You're just done. You've been sitting in the Führer's office way too long, my friend.
Oh God. Any other comments before we move on?
Millington's crazy. Let's move on.
At Maiden's Point, Jean and Phyllis swim fully dressed. Ms. Hardikin had taken their swimsuits earlier and splashing around as a mist drifts over the bay. And they claim the water is very warm. When it clears, the girls have disappeared. Jean and Phyllis rise from the waves, skin pale with long claws in place of fingernails. They lure a Soviet soldier into the water. Before he can reach them, monstrous hands drag him under. Millington is informed that the operations of the church are being closed down. He orders that all radio transmitters and outside telephone lines be disabled and any chess sets be burned. Justin decrypts the inscription and the Ultima spits out, "Let the chains of Fenric shatter." Ace realizes that the inscriptions are a complex logic diagram for a computer program and tells Judson this in his office. With this knowledge, Judson excitedly tells Crane to take him to the Ultima room. Meanwhile, Jean and Phyllis kill Miss Hardikin. Ace and Doctor find the body later drained of blood, and the two Hemivore girls are already approaching Wainwright, who has lost his faith when he hears, loses more of his faith when he hears about British bombs killing innocents. They are about to feed on him when the doctor arrives and dismisses them. They threaten to return for Wainwright. The doctor says everything will be all right as long as Judson doesn't solve the inscription. Ace, horrified, realizes she's given Judson the solution and says the doctor should have told her his plan. They rush to the Ultima room as Hermivores rise from the bay. When the doctor, Ace, and the vicar reach the machine, it runs at top speed and can't be stopped. The urn Ace found in the tunnels glows with a green light as Millington triumphantly says the doctor is too late. He is convinced that once the chains of Fenric shatter, all its dark power will be his. Cut to credits.
You know, when you read the plot like this out loud, this show sounds stupid.
You know, that is not the first time you said that during this run.
This is one of the few times where it's like, honestly, the summary is not really doing the show at all justice, because there's no way to explain it without sounding like you're just, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. Because, I mean, it's like, okay, the ancient Viking inscriptions are simultaneously summoning a god and also a logic program for vampires that are Viking vampires that have drowned 1,000 years ago. They're now coming back while a Soviet team steals a computer and accidentally chemical weapons that are meant to destroy Russia. All so that this military commander can possess the powers of a god. I think I've played this Call of Cthulhu game now that I say it.
God. Yeah, but it's Doctor Who.
Right. And that's the thing, is like, I still love this episode. And even more, because it's just, this is a show that, I've said this before, I think, but this is a show at this era that's confident. Season 26 is confident. It's like, we know we're gonna do it, and we're gonna do it to the best of our ability. And like, in the middle of all of this nonsense, they cram in a really poignant story about how horrifying war is and how it's so bad that a vicar loses his faith in God and humanity in a very real and tangible way. So, and again, this is pointing towards to new Doctor Who, because this is a Doctor Who that recognizes that the human stories are what give the nonsense sci-fi stuff context and interest.
Do you know a couple of the actors that were in competition to play the Vicar? This is something I read on the TARDIS wiki.
I didn't know. No.
Christopher Eccleston and Peter Capaldi.
Really?
Wouldn't that have been different?
Wow, that's wild. Oh, yeah, Christopher Eccleston playing the Vicar would have been amazing. Because he does that. His facial expressions are so good. Oh, it would have been so. I'm imagining it now, and it would have been fantastic.
And Peter Capaldi could have played one more role in Doctor Who before he became the Doctor.
Right.
Giving him three or four at that point in time.
Jesus Christ, Peter. Capaldi's great. Anyway, I do want to go back since Gina Tholson are dead.
And they're not dead. They're undead.
They're vampires.
Oh. Hemivores.
They're vampires.
Hemivores.
They're the explicitly called vampires by people in this episode. Doctor corrects them and says they're hemivores because vampires are a different thing that fights Time Lords. And I imagine a cut line of like, what do you mean vampires different? I don't know how to explain. But when that, now they're hemivores. This arc of London girls are basically die because of their horrible, ungodly ways. Weirdly, actually pans out. Because they told you don't like repeatedly. Everyone in this episode says, don't go swim in the water, and like, we're gonna go swim in the water, and they do, and they come back, and there's a great scene of them like drawing the stocking seams on because they don't want to look like they're still wearing stockings, but they actually their stockings have been ruined. And she's like, "You wicked girls," and Miss Hardick kind of just goes off on them for doing horrible things, for swimming in the water, and it's like, do you not get the metaphor that swimming in the water is sex yet? Because that's going to be important in episode 3. Swimming in the water, by the way, is sex.
Oh.
And so this is a story about alien STDs.
That is what you come to. All of that to reach that point. Not the Ultra Machine, not the coming of the gods, not Millington's zaniness, not Judson, who's running around deciphering everything. Space STDs.
Space STDs. But I mean, to a larger point, the one thing that I like about this, one of the things I will say that watching the episode is better than watching the movie version, if you will, is the fact is that the first time I watched this, granted, I watched this as an American. I watched this as one episode, so I didn't have an episode moment. But like, even though halfway through, I'm like, what the actual hell is going on, right? There's a ton of mystery happening here. How does this Ultra Machine thing tie into this? And what is the Doctor's plan? So, like, this does all actually tie together. This is all one story. But at this moment, it's really – it feels like there's five stories going on here. And they're all interesting. And so, like, I don't know what's going on. But the Gina Phyllis thing, I think it's a slightly weird that, again, I think just one of the few casualties of the tight editing is that Ace is suddenly best friends with them, and then they treat her like crap all of a sudden. And it's like, oh, they're just horrible, wicked girls. The implication from the storytelling perspective is that they're wicked because they're from London. And that's not true, because Ace is also from London and doesn't do this, but she also does go swimming in the water. Because that's a metaphor for sex. But the idea is that why do they suddenly just treat her like crap? And the answer is, it's not that they're not from London that they're horrible. It's just that they're just two horrible children that have been traumatized by war, and they're acting out by rejecting. Like, who the hell are you? My parents are dead. What if life is not worth living anymore? We're going to do what the hell we want. And Ace is like, actually, maybe don't do these horrible things, because my friend who's an alien in a big blue box told me it's good. You shouldn't do it. You know what? Never mind. Just go swim in the water. Whatever.
And funnily enough, though, like, now that you're saying that, one of the things is a lot, this is more from research, in they had to make them older, in my opinion, is because I don't think people could have handled, if we remove your sex metaphor, if people couldn't have handled seeing like 9 and 12 year old kids having experienced that war and being transferred out to live somewhere else, which is closer to what really happened sometimes during the war itself, where you had like all these kids shipped off to the country to have to endure and having lost their parents and everything else.
Right. Right. So their age is ambiguous in the episode. It feels like the intention was they were meant to be mid to late teenage girls, 16 to 18. And I think where the episode landed on was early 20s. So that women who had autonomy but still needed a place to stay. And therefore, when they reject the comforts they were given to go do their own thing and then become vampires, if they're in their early 20s, it's not as bad. But if they're teenagers, that probably would have been bad. So it's like, let's just kind of not talk about how old they are. Mm-hmm. But I think I'm with you. Like, they're clearly meant to be some level of still need parents in terms of age group. And which makes which if you go with that route from a story perspective, again, there's a lot of metatextual stuff happening here. The break with Ace makes more sense because Ace is no longer as old as them. Ace has matured, again, in some nebulous way. So she has matured and realized that you can't just rebel. This is part of Ace's growth, because if this had been post-Dragonfire Ace, she absolutely would have gone off and done this.
Yeah.
She's matured. In the water. She's different now. Which is why, again, maybe doing Battlefield after this maybe makes some kind of thematic sense, because it's she's matured enough to know that that's dangerous to do. And then in Battlefield, she's matured even more to realize that sometimes you have to do the things dangerous for the good reason.
And she gets a girlfriend in Battlefield.
And all right. She does.
Anything else about who's better than part Soren? Two?
Right. Yeah, that's good.
A spoiler, Soren, who's going to become... All right, part three. The Doctor states that the base's defenses are weakened because Millington wanted the Soviets to steal the Ultima machine, and the transmitters are disabled. Plan.
So bad.
He explains the herbivores are mutations from humanity's far future. Ace wants to ensure that Kathleen and Audrey are all right before returning to the church. Wainwright writes down the Viking descendants' names while the Doctor and Ace explore the crypt for clues. Ace finds a cool-looking cast-aside urn and puts it in her backpack without telling the Doctor. Wainwright finds the names the Doctor is looking for, the curse of Fenric passed down through the generations. The Hermivores attack the church in force! A side note, did you know that, at least in a cut version, I think it's re-added in, Sylvester McCoy's wife and kids visited, and J&T let the kids play the kid Hermivores. And Ace tries to escape via rooftop, but is attacked. Soren and his soldiers rush to the rescue, slowing down the Hermivores by filling them full of bullets and sound effects that are not properly synced. The Doctor's faith drives back the Hermivores. He chants the names of his former companions. The Doctor explains that faith forms a psychic barrier that the Hermivores cannot penetrate. He then orders everyone into the crypt, but Soren says, "Nay, I must return to my men on the beach." He and H share a weird sort of look. His faith is in Viva Revolution! And he leaves the church. The Doctor finds a tunnel to the toxic stores and a back way out. Is sealed, but Ace blows him up with the two cans of Nitro 9. It should have been one. The two Soviet soldiers stay behind to slow down the Hermivores stalking them through the tunnels, which would have been a very cool scene to see. Ace takes out the flash he found, hoping to use it to make more Nitro 9. The Doctor recognizes the treasure they've been searching for. Outside, Soren keeps the Hermivores at bay with his Soviet Army badge. But they then turn away from him and start moving back towards the church, being drawn to the flask that was with them all the time, but obviously needs to be out in the open to function. When the Doctor, Wainwright, and Ace reach the exit, Millington is waiting for them and takes the flask, sealing the exit that's trapping the two Soviet soldiers inside, then recapping a story of what a terrible, terrible officer he is and having his men previously die. They plead with Millington to open the shutters, but their pleas are ignored. What do you think of that fight scene, Eddie?
So your plan is, what if I take the things that are keeping me safe, but make less of those? That will be great.
Yeah. What do you think of that epic fight scene in the church with the vicar banging to keep the herbivores out, the doctor on one end, Ace having a ladder in her backpack?
The ladder is great. I love the ladder. No, I mean, it's a zombie movie shtick, which is fascinating because this is before zombie movies became a really strong trope.
Well, I think a little man named Romero would have some issues with that statement, Eddie.
I said a trope. I didn't say they didn't exist. I said they were not a trope anymore. There's not so many movies riffing off of Romero that it became a whole genre. So I think it was meant to be their own homage simply to Romero, not to zombie movies in general.
Do you know who else would have a little problem with that statement?
Who?
Mr. Sam Raimi, who at this time would have had out Evil Dead 1 and 2, I think. Yeah, and Armored Darkness.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Armored Darkness is iffy, but no. I think Armored Darkness is out, too. I'm iffy on Armored Darkness, but definitely Evil Dead 1 and 2.
Then maybe it's more of an Evil Dead reference then at that point. But still, it's Doctor Who going back to horror, right? And doing a pretty good job of it, honestly.
It was always good at horror, like during that Tom Baker era. Oh, those are some brilliant episodes.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, Brain of Morbius and all that.
The Lighthouse one with Rutens for me will always be like top notch. Like that was just.
Ugh. Yeah. So.
I covered a lot, didn't I?
Yeah. Well, I mean, like the agnostic faith angle is something that definitely stuck with me, especially since soon after this, I would start playing Vampire the Masquerade. So the idea of it's not what you have faith in, just you have faith, really stuck with me throughout the entire time of doing vampire stuff. And I absolutely comes to this. And it's funny, if like for so long, I always thought the Russian one was the weakest point. But again, to circle back to my thing on Stalin, one of the things that has since come out about the Bolshevik Revolution is that it was absolutely treated. They said religion is the opium of the masses. We don't all religious iconography is taken down. So instead, put your faith into Bolshevism, and the language they use around it explicitly parodied Russian Orthodoxy. So a Soviet captain using his pin as a source of faith is absolutely what would have been happening in late 80s Russia because the state was a source of faith for them. So it's fascinating that that actually does turn out to track really well and parallels well. And the scene of Ace flirting with him, like for so many years, it pissed me off. Cause like, she's so bad at this. And then about 20 years ago, I came to peace with it with a sense of, well, no, I was also shitty at flirting with people as a teenager. So that tracks. But now it's like, no, the reason why she's bad at flirting with boys is because she's much better at flirting with girls.
So much like you, the idea of just faith itself and not necessarily being related to any certain religion is something that always stuck with me. It's something that I've believed in most of my life. For me, it was awkward with that belief growing up because my grandmother and great grandmother had these grand dreams of me becoming a preacher. And that's what they're really forcing me to do. They were trying to integrate me more and more into the church.
Oh, wow.
You see how well that worked out.
Well. Yeah, that didn't work out at all.
Sitting here on a podcast with you instead of having a flock of people adhering to my every word. And then I question, maybe I didn't make the right choice.
I don't know. You have some listeners.
I thank you, the 30 people that download our episode every single week.
It's better than one.
And for you other 500 that only do it on occasions, step up your game. So joking aside, I really did enjoy the church combat scene. It was sillily done, but the concept behind it is excellent. And from what the budget they had, even more kudos go to them for that. and then the sort of the underground travel through the tunnel done infinitely better than like Ian going through a tunnel underground, jumping over a pit.
I mean, it's funny, like in a lot of ways, this Curse of Fenric is ultimately a Second Doctor story, right? It's a base under siege. We have a community of people. There is a commander who is not right in the head, and there's a person who's actually causing all the problems. And the people who are all part of the staff of the base have to work together to try to repel the outside invaders who are steadily getting closer and closer to destroying them. It's, you know, the moon base. It's Siege of Cybermen. It's, you know, the invasion. It's a Second Doctor story, but done so much better in a lot of ways. And part of it is this faith component, because it's Millington has removed the physical defenses and they're forced to rely on spiritual defenses. And then having the explicitly spiritual leader be the one who crumbles is also really interesting and telling. And the best part is that it's not a sudden swerve. It's tragic because he's been saying, I've lost my faith to humanity, I lost faith to humanity. And everyone's like, no, you'll be fine. The war is over. Everyone will survive. And it's just not enough. It's so beautifully poignant. Again, something that Eccleston would have pulled off amazing. Not that this actor did a bad job, but Eccleston would have been amazing pulling that off.
It also shows how much he must have generally cared about people on the whole before the war.
Mm-hmm.
That is, in of itself, is a character point that is not lost, but it's not highlighted. And people could consider like his loss of faith to be a weakness, but it is, in a way, like his strength of character is his own downfall.
Right. Honestly, if he could have recontextualized his head to have had faith in the community rather than faith in God, he probably would have survived that encounter. Because it's clear he loves the village. It's like, I have all the names of all the – I've studied the history of the village. I have all the names of the descendants. It's clear that's where his passion was, and that's where his faith lived, because he believed the village would be fine. There's nothing about the community he was ever worried about through all this. It's always this abstract ideals of God and humanity that tore him down. So like, if he could have grounded his logic – and again, this is one thing where the show's playing with stereotypes, because like the village vicar, who turns out to be – not as full of faith as he seems to be, but he's still a good man and a good contribution to this community. So I like how the show is setting up all the stereotypes and then carefully subverting them as it goes through without spending a lot of time dwelling on those or making them a big reveal. It's just kind of, you have to kind of pull this stuff apart like we're doing to show, oh, actually, here's this theme going on. Here's this theme going on. Here's this theme going on. There's so many actual themes happening here. It's really, really great.
Any other comments about this before we move on?
No, because we have to keep yourself an episode and a half to get through.
My one question for you is, how do you think Don French would have pulled off being the vicar?
Oh, that would be interesting.
If people don't know what I'm talking about, go Google it and find the show. Soren tells his troops to abort the mission at camp if he's not back in 10 minutes. He calls out Millington to talk terms, officer to officer. However, Millington is an ass and arrests Soren instantly, who manages to warn his troops. The Hermivores start to burn through the metal shutters of the tunnel, while Ace discovers Kathleen sitting alone in the barracks, numb with grief, having received a letter informing her of her husband's death at sea. Judson continues decoding the inscriptions with the flask sitting at the Ultima machine. Ace confronts a doctor, demanding to know what his plan is. And he bitterly complains that he always seems to know. Oh, sorry. She bitterly complains he always seems to know, but just can't be bothered to tell anyone. Like it's a game that only he knows the rules to. The doctor tells Ace about an ancient evil that has existed since the birth of the universe. Fenric is just Millington's name for it, and it is trapped in the flask. Ace lures Soren's guards away with some heavy flirting. Ace lures the guards away from Soren with some heavy flirting. While the doctor frees the captain, the trio of them rush around a bit. Wainwright waits for the Hermivores to break the tunnel gates, and he holds them back for the briefest of moments with his faith before they overwhelm him. The flask in the Ultima flashes. Well, that's a bad phrasing. Hitting Judson with green energy, causing him to collapse from his wheelchair. A storm whips up as the Hermivores advance over Wainwright's lifeless body. As Ace, the Doctor, and Soren reach the Ultima room, Millington murmurs that the chains of Fenric are shattered and the gods have lost the final battle. Ace thinks that Finric has just taken Millington, but she's wrong. Behind the doctor, Finric possessed Judson rises to his feet, his eyes glowing yellow, and proclaims, "We play the contest again, Time Lord." Cut to credits.
Oh, God. So good. I love the fake out of it's not Millington that gets possessed, but Judson, because like the whole episode is building towards that moment. And it's one of those, especially watching it again, like how good the show sets up that Judson was always going to be the one possessed.
Yeah.
Because Millington may have been the one who was the brains behind this operation, but Judson was the one doing the actual connection with the material. He was the one who actually had an obsession with power. He constantly talked about how he was trapped by his wheelchair, which is a very real feeling for disabled people. And so it's a very understandable resonance. But once, as we learn more about Fenric, it's like, of course they're going to take Judson because he's the one who desperately needs power. Millington just wants it, again, in an abstract way. Of course I want to be and have power. I think it'd be great. Judson's like, no, I need it. He needs it on a deep-seated level. That's very clear from the beginning. So it's one of those great fake-outs that when it happens, you're like, holy shit, I didn't see that coming. But then it's like, no, I should have seen it coming. And that's the best way, the best kind of fake-outs.
Absolutely agree. I don't have anything to add to that because it was beautifully done. Any comments? Because otherwise I'm just going to jump to four. Because it's built up to us moving on. There's a lot that happened, but like, we're about to.
So, again, to continue the metaphor, this is, for me, has always been an episode, a story about Ace's sexuality in a way that they are desperately trying to get across in 80s children's television. And so her doctor's like, we need to strike the guard. And Ace's like, I got it. And she goes off. And for the first time, she doesn't hit someone with a baseball bat. She doesn't blow them up. She seduces them in the most Anakin Skywalker way ever. It's like, I feel the wind blowing. How does that feel? And the soldier's like, yeah, whatever you said, pretty lady. You're crazy, but you're pretty. And she straight up uses her sexuality to manipulate someone in a way that she has never done before and arguably since. And again, like if you're just watching this in isolation, it's so weird, right? If you're just watching just Curse of Fenric, it's so weird. But if you've been watching through season 25, season 26, this is the natural outcome of like, you don't always have to hit things and blow them up. Anger is not the only solution to a problem. Ace is finally coming to terms with that. She realizes there are other, she's trying to be like the doctor. She's trying to manipulate people into doing what she wants. And it's a clumsy attempt, but it is a sincere attempt of like, what if I just talk them into doing the thing I want? And she's doing it in a way that only she as a young woman can do in this moment. So it's actually quite an empowering moment for Ace to do this. And of course it's clumsy because she's a teenager. It's the first time she's really tried this. And again, arguably because she's much better with women. But even with that off the table, you know, this still reads well. And again, like this is after Ghostlight, where it was another show about her coming to terms with her identity as a woman, although in a very different way. So it still resonates in this order, although again, you could do it in reverse order of like her trying it out here and then wanting to explore that more fully in Ghostlight. It plays either way, honestly. But it shows that this is a show that's trying to illustrate that the companion is actually the character we want to follow. The doctor is just a vehicle for that to happen.
And that was the full intent of Cartmell and everyone else. That's how they had the mystery back to the doctor. And they would then focus on the companion stories, which works great.
Yeah.
I think some of the newer Who may have overdone it a little bit. And then they tried to do a full retcon of it, which then they overstepped doing that too. So it's a tricky balance, and to see that they pulled it off in the 80s is phenomenal.
Right. Especially considering in this part, Ace calls out, you know, hey, you always have these manipulative plans. And she's absolutely right. If a doctor had told her the plan, things would not be going this badly wrong. So again, it's interesting that the companion not only is the viewpoint vehicle of let's understand the Doctor's mysterious actions, but also she's objectively correct in the fact that the Doctor was wrong to not tell her what was going on.
Any final thoughts on episode three, part three? Just for simplicity's sake, I'm just going to say Fenric, unless he switches bodies and I may change it. Fenric recaps that the Doctor trapped him in the shadow dimension since the third century, but now his plans can continue. He teleports away as British soldiers rush in. Millington orders the Doctor, Ace, and Soren be shot for treason. Before the firing squad can carry out the orders, Soren's troops attack and the trio escape. Fenric orders the Hermivores to fetch him the Ancient One, a hideously mutated Hermivore. The Ancient One is from Earth's far future, a time where it is the last thing alive, the ultimate destiny that evolution and pollution have stamped shape for mankind. The Doctor and Ace barely avoid death traps in Millington's office, trying to claim a chessboard. Meanwhile, Millington meets Fenric in the toxic chamber, where Fenric reminisces about the Doctor beating him, carving chess pieces out of the bones from the desert sands. Fenric could not solve the puzzle and was banished. So now he seeks revenge. The Doctor explains to Ace why the names are important. They tell of where the curse has passed to family names like Judson, Millington, Wainwright, Dudman. Ace remembers that Kathleen has a chess set that has escaped Millington's destruction, and the duo go to retrieve it. The British soldiers use toxic grenades against the Soviets, but the Hermivores start killing the British soldiers. The WRNs become Hermivores and turn on the soldiers who come to rescue them. Fenric orders the Hermivores to kill Nurse Crane in return for the humiliation she forced on Judson over the years. When Bates, I think they're playing a riff for Gates, by the way. Guard commander goes to warn Millington of the massacre. He overhears Fenric tell Millington that he will use the toxin stores to poison the world forever. Bates sneaks out and joins forces with the Doctor and Soren to fight the real enemy. Soren praises Ace for her bravery and gives her his Soviet Army badge in the most cringeworthy scene I've seen in days.
Yeah.
Ace and the Doctor reach the barracks and take Kathleen's chessboard, but Ace stays to look after Kathleen and Audrey. The Hermivores crash in through the window. They barely escape through another one. Ace bundles Kathleen and Audrey into a jeep, telling them to go to London, where Ace's Nan will look after them. Kathleen gives Ace a picture of Audrey because everyone carries a Hollywood photo shot of their baby in World War II. Ace kisses the baby goodbye, saying she will always love her, and they drive off. Fenric tells the Ancient One to take the poison to the ocean and kill the other Hermivores. He concentrates, and the Hermivores collapse, crumbling to dust. And so do the vampires. Jean and Phyllis in front of the horrified Ace. The Doctor sets up the chess puzzle in the toxic stores and challenges Fenric to solve it. Millington is about to shoot Bates, but Soren's last soldier kills Millington instead. And I'm stopping there because that was a lot.
Yeah.
I went through more of it because we're in a time crunch now.
Right. I both have a lot to say and not much to say.
Yeah.
little things. Like, I love the atmosphere of this, right? Like, on some level, this is ultimately, here's the monster who's arrived to break shit and we have to stop him, right? So I mean, it's a bog standard Doctor Who plot at this point going forward. But a lot of it's because of the flavor and structure of it. Just little things like carving chess pieces out of bones from desert sands. It's like it evokes a whole continuity of the Doctor that we've never seen, which is wonderful, and I love it.
And that's a story I want to see now.
Yeah, right. Totally. And we have all the plot threads kind of coming together. And in the middle of all of this, it's the, oh, and by the way, this is actually all secretly a story about toxic waste and pollution. So surprise theme. But again, it involves some magic because, this toxin that they covered that was supposed to destroy Russia ends up destroying the whole world and creating the Hemivores that came back in time. It all these bizarre threads actually connect together and make sense. And like, here's why all these people are in this village, because they're all the descendants of these Vikings that were picked up by the original thing. And it's just, oh, it's so good. So it's a bunch of stuff, but it doesn't feel like a bunch of psychobabble. It feels like a natural collection of all these plot pieces. What the hell is going on? It's like, here in episode four, boom, here it all comes together in a logical, nice way that doesn't feel forced, and it's just incredible.
And it goes back to what you touched on earlier, is that it has a horror movie structure. Mm-hmm. And so you have all the people you've built up, and you've reached sort of that moment where the killer is now going to really kick up in the top gear. And we have all that. And that's why you care about the characters, or you should care about the characters. And we may have joked about some of the relationships, but they're now what everything is built to. And you're going to see all of that pay off in the next 15, 20 minutes.
Yep. So let's talk about them.
All right. As Finrick desperately contemplates the chess puzzle, the Doctor speaks to the Ancient One. He knows the Ancient One comes from a world where the industrial pollution has caused Earth to die in a chemical slime. And what Finrick is asking the Hermivores to do is the act that begins it. Another one of Finrick's games. When Soren goes to kill Finrick, the weakened entity possessing Judson tells Soren that he was chosen for this mission because his grandmother was English and a descendant of one of the Viking settlers. Soren is touched by the curse too, and one of the wolves of Finrick, I think would have been a better title. When Ace enters the toxic stores, it is Soren who is contemplating the puzzle, and Ace tells him to Lucian, realizing too late that he is now Finrick. Finrick solves a puzzle as the Doctor enters, and he gloats. All the descendants of the Vikings who buried the Flask were pawns in his game. Judson, Millington, Soren, the Ancient One, and Ace. In 30 years, Kathleen Dudman's daughter, Audrey, will become Ace's mother, the one who Ace hates. In saving Kathleen and Audrey, Ace has created her own future. Finrick orders the Ancient One to kill them. Ace, however, has absolute faith in the Doctor's and creates a psychic shield the Ancient One can't break through. Finrick takes a vial of toxin, saying that he will kill the Doctor anyway, but the Doctor can save Ace if he kneels before him. The Doctor callously tells him to kill her, revealing that he knew all along that Ace had been Finrick's evil, the evil inside of her. Why else would he have taken in a social misfit who couldn't even pass her chemistry test, yet somehow created a time storm in her bedroom? The Doctor saw Finrick's hand in it from the very start. And the Doctor shatters Ace's faith in him, and she falls to the ground weeping. And the Ancient One takes a vial of poison and puts himself and Finrick into the chamber and explodes the gas in, killing them both. The Doctor tries to explain to Ace that he didn't mean what he said, but he had to break her faith so that the Ancient One could take him. On the shores of Maiden's Point, Ace wonders why she can't stop hating Audrey, her mother, even though she loved her as a baby. Ace dives into the bay, no longer frightened of the water, and surfaces liberated. In doing so, it's implied that she's overcome her psychological troubles and hatred of her mother to face a brighter future with the Doctor, as the duo walk back to the TARDIS and make a quip about the danger sign.
Danger sign.
There you go.
So there's a delightful triple game happening here. I want to wait till the end to talk about it. So chess is a very heavy metaphor throughout this whole thing. Like, and I'm not a big fan of chess as a metaphor for political planning, because I think it's way overdone. I think it works here because of what's happening. They're not playing chess. There's a puzzle that has to be solved. And we kind of glossed over it. But basically, the solution to the puzzle is that you have to break the rules of the game, right? It's that the pawns overthrow the king. That's the only way you can solve the puzzle. And so Fenric goes, thank you for giving me a solution, and then proceeds to play. At some point in time, the Doctor makes a joke about, I'm not playing chess, I'm playing poker. Because what Fenric has completely missed the entire point of the puzzle. The chess puzzle, the game they're playing is the Doctor knows that Fenric does not understand metaphor. So the point is that the villain is explicitly told the pawns overthrow the king, and he goes, cool, let me now lay out all of my pawns and then proceed to go blithely into the plan I've laid out. and then is shocked when the pawn overthrows the king. So the doctor, and this, again, this beautifully goes back to way back in the beginning. We joked about this. The doctor openly forged his own credential letters. The doctor left the solution to this entire problem in plain sight for anyone to see. And the villain completely misses it. And that's the game the doctor's playing. He is playing poker. Because he's like, I have a good hand. I'm going to show you my good hand and still bluff you into not accepting that's the truth. And it's this to me is the seventh doctor. The fact that the Ace is rightfully mad at the fact that the doctor explained his plan is counterbalanced by the fact that Ace keeps fucking up his plan.
Yeah. Right?
But her argument is, if you told me the whole plan, I wouldn't have made those mistakes, which is valid. The reality, and this is why I get sometimes frustrated by some of the Seventh Doctor's manifestation, is that the Seventh Doctor is not a master manipulator. He's making it as he goes along. He can't tell Ace the plan because there is no plan to tell her.
He is a high-level outline, is right, what exactly. It is.
Yeah, it's the I've outlined this. I've got maybe a few parts sketched out, a few pieces I know need to happen in a certain order, but I'm going to improv like easily 40% of this plan. So I can't tell you what I'm doing because I'm in the middle of it while I'm doing it.
But I also know a lot of the different resources I have that I can apply to specific situations. So that's beautiful.
Right. And that's why the conversation between Ace and Doctor is so fascinating, is because it could have very easily been, I can't explain to you my plan because you're a dumb girl, right? I mean, and to be fair, the third Doctor had some versions of that conversation in his run. Instead, what has happened here is that Ace and the Doctor are both talking around the elephants of the fact is that the Doctor is trying to say, I can't tell you my plan because I don't always know how it's going to plan out, and I've got to sometimes improv and move things along. And Ace is saying, if I had more of the context you're working from, I could improv with you. And she's proved through Curse of Fenric that she can do the Doctor's job. She's not just a blunt instrument of a baseball bat and Venture 9. You know, she can actually keep pace with the Doctor if she's allowed to. And when she does, the problem is that when she shows that she's able to do that, she's inadvertently tripping the Doctor's plan up. But she's showing that I have the capacity to actually do this. And so it's frustrating that she has exactly one episode, one story after this to prove that that's true before the show ends. But, I mean, we have this fantastic moments of the Doctor's trying to tear her down, and immediately like, I'm sorry, I didn't mean any of that, but she is hurt by this and she is changed by this, but it doesn't eradicate their friendship because she's moved to the next stage of her growing up as an adult, which is realism. Her idealism is now tempered by realism, because before she had blind idealism. That's why the faith worked. Now she doesn't have that anymore. So she doesn't have that blind faith in Doctor anymore, but she has a much more tempered, realistic faith of, I know the ultimate would be in the end. I recognize sometimes we're not going to agree.
Very well stated.
Also, her diving into the water after Soren flirts with her is because it's about sex.
Some people say that it could be rebirth, which still at the end of the day deals with sex and having to be birth and coming from the ridiculous. One of the other things that I glanced when I quickly moved past in the shortened recap is because he mentions a time storm, and time storm is even mentioned for the Ancient One. So if you're not sure about Ace yet, they've sort of seeded in points where you can understand that Ace is also going to be one of the wolves. And those are nice little touches that are even in this episode, in case you didn't know it yet. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to when you last episode, when you talked about Ace blowing, making a time storm and blowing yourself somewhere else into space is unreasonable.
Yep.
This is why I love it so much, is because it links back to this. And it is an unreasonable thing that she managed to do that.
Right. And that's, why I kind of mentioned it before is because I knew we were talking about it here, is that it's a nonsense bullshit bit of plotting that Cartmel and his team have turned around to say, okay, we're going to solve that by saying, yes, that is nonsense. And what about that? They took the inadequacies of previous scripts and made them into plot points. And what's fascinating about this part is in the reconciliation, the doctor never says, I didn't mean to hurt you. I didn't mean to lose my faith to you. I had to tear down what you thought of me. He never says what I said was wrong, right? He never invalidates that, yes, Fenris's evil is inside of her, and that's one of the reasons why he picked her up. He never invalidates that narrative. He just says, I do care about you, I do love you, and I didn't want to hurt you. So both of these things can be true, which is that, yes, she is one of the wolves of Fenric, but yes, the doctor does care about her deeply and wants her to be more than that, which is this huge thing that just falls away because Doctor Who has never done this kind of long-term narrative building before.
And this point, though, when he breaks her down here, is something that is never lost. It comes up in the Wilderness Years and all like the new adventure books that they're in together. She never has the amount of faith in the Doctor again as she did before this point, ever. Like, she may care about him and view him more as it goes on, more as a friend than a mentor father figure. And mm-hmm. It is constantly reinforced. If you go and read the new adventure novels that we may or may not talk about, their relationship becomes incredibly antagonistic.
Yep.
Shortly after this. And in the Power of the Doctor, which we can see on screen, there's sort of an acknowledgement of some of this.
Right. But and again, like we were talking before about how, as a result of being this long running program, you have these great middle-aged women who are fantastic. The little bit she has in the Power of the Doctor, it's like, of course she's a huge badass wearing a suit that's managing a group of people who are helping, you know, just basically just this fierce social justice warrior, for lack of a better term, because she has found a way to channel the wolf in her into positive change. And that's kind of where her story arc is always going, was like she has this powerful force inside of her. It doesn't have to be shaped in one particular area. But what's brilliant about this is that a lot of fans have read this era. I think we're moving to wrap up now, but a lot of fans have read this era and this episode as the Doctor has this massive master plan for Ace, and it's all of these things are part of his elaborate plan to Ace for. I don't buy that. I've always interpreted the Seventh Doctor as not getting humans very well. This is the Doctor probably at one of his most alien moments, short of early Hartnell and chunks of Tom Baker, right? This is probably his most alien. And it really feels like he just doesn't get how people work. And I love that about him. I love the fact that, because it gives Ace agency. There's a lot of, from that perspective, a lot of Battlefield, a lot of Curse of Fenric, that really reads like, if you just got how people worked, this wouldn't be a big deal for you. I'm not something to solve. And so you get that kind of almost, I'm going to say this, Watsonian Sherlockian dynamic of the Doctor being the intellectual who doesn't understand people and Ace and Watson role going, just fucking talk to people, you know?
All right. So we are definitely in the closing. Any final thoughts on this episode?
I'm curious of your thoughts. I mean, I know we both love this, and I've been talking a lot about it. I want to make sure I'm not giving you space to talk about what you love about this.
Well, a lot of it is that this is where our similarities are too similar. So I don't want to repeat what you said, because most of the feelings are the same. For me, the biggest thing is I want to reinforce again, Ace's diving into the water was sort of like the symbolic break of that hatred, which we would have seen in Ghostlight, which we saw in Ghostlight, which was staggering. And then later on, when you'll eventually, that if we were to do another survival, we might have seen Ace's friends that she also kind of talks about. But no, this episode is the pinnacle of me for the classic Doctor Who run. It has everything that I love. It's my Doctor being my Doctor, and it influences all of Doctor Who going forward. Every single piece of it after this is now solidly entrenched in how this episode is formed and its structure.
Yeah. And as much shtick as we have sidewise given to the 96 Doctor Who movie, you could see them trying to take the lessons of this season and apply them and just pick all the wrong lessons from it, right? It's like, I see what you're trying to do here. Just across the board, the wrong answer. So yeah, it's I keep saying it, but this is one of my favorite seasons of Doctor Who. Like, there's a reason why I have the season on Blu-ray. I Ace is always going to be my companion. Like, you know, if you talk to the Crush Corner, I'm with you there. Ace was one of my crushes too growing up, but not even in a sexual way, right? But also just in a I see a lot of myself in her way. Because yeah, I also am angry and would love to smash things. And also, over time, I have come to recognize that a baseball bat is not always the answer to societal problems, as tempting and as comforting as that might be.
Just and 8 out of 10.
Yeah, yeah. And I've also flirted badly with men, so I also am excited about it.
Love it. Did you have a quote for us as we wrap up?
I do. Because... oh God, there's so many good Doctor Who, Seventh Doctor quotes in particular. But I've settled on this one because it's appropriate to this episode, which is, you can always judge a man by the quality of his enemies.
Excellent. Excellent one. So Eddie, does this mean that we're finally done with classic Doctor Who and people that want us to talk about other things can expect that to happen at long last? We can go and talk about, I don't know, Airwolf. For instance.
No, we're not quite done. We are going to talk a little bit more of Seventh Doctor. I mean, we love Seventh Doctor. This is part of the reason why we're doing this. So we're going to stretch it a little bit. We are going to talk about Survival. We're going to have a special guest, Rose Bailey,
who
not only has worked with both of us professionally, but also is just as much an avid fan of Doctor Who as we are. Grew up about the same time with us. I think we're all kind of in the same boat as American Doctor Who fans growing up in the 80s. So we're going to talk about the very last episode, Survival.
Do we want to go ahead and give people an idea of what's coming up even after that one?
Feel free. Go ahead. Spoil the mystery.
Well, this, in case people don't have access to something, I want them to be able to go ahead and find them to you.
I know. That's fine.
One of the things that we've decided to do is huge Doctor Who fans is that we will not be done with Doctor Who probably for another 4 weeks, I think.
Yeah.
I don't even have my skit. I don't even have the document up anymore. But so Rose is going to come on and we're all going to talk about Survival next week, which will be, I hope, as much fun as I think it's going to be.
Mm-hmm.
We'll touch on the Wilderness Years. So if anyone's curious what the Wilderness Years are, a brief overview is when the Seventh Doctor run ended up until basically the new season started. It's kind of the Wilderness Years. There are a bunch of books and novels and whatnot that came out.
Right.
And
there's two rough halves to that because the 96 movie falls in the middle of that.
And Eddie, would you let them, I closed the document already, so sorry. Would you let them know the three things from the Wilderness Years? So if people want to try to track them down, because it's not going to be easy to find necessarily, which is why I want to give people a primer for that.
Right. So for preface for that episode, we're not going to do our usual kind of breakdown and walk through an episode thing. Rather, it's going to be more, we're going to talk about a few pieces of media from that time period, kind of more in abstract to kind of give you a flavor for the Wilderness Years. So we're going to talk about Downtime, which was a film in 1995, made with some of the actors in Doctor Who in a legally distinct way. We're going to talk about Curse of the Fatal Death, which was a comic relief skit that was done about Doctor Who during this time period, written by Stephen Moffat. So we have something looking backwards Doctor Who, written by someone who eventually would go on to write Doctor Who. And then Doctor Who Love and War, which is one of the tie-in novels from this era, one of the high points of this era, and also features Bernice Summerfield, who is one of the long-standing outgrowths of this era that has moved on to have her own massive franchise.
Eddie, do we expect our listeners to read the novel?
No.
Love and War?
No. I mean, you can find Downtime and Curse and Fatal Death online. There is an audio adaptation of Love and War. But again, unlike previous episodes, this is more just, we're taking these three pieces of media as a way to talk about the three different rough threads of what was happening to Doctor Who during this time period where there was no Doctor Who on the air.
And if I have time, I may read the book, but as we know, I am the guy that was watching the episode last night. We'll see. Right. Afterwards, we're also going to do two big finish audios.
Yes.
And then we'll eventually transition out of Doctor Who. It'll be sad, but I think we'll eventually get out of Doctor Who.
Right. Because again, like during this, those will kind of cover the later Wilderness Years when Big Finish thought they were more or less doing, well, that's the thing is that Big Finish / Virgin Books / BBC Books all thought they were doing kind of official continuation of Doctor Who. And so Big Finish is the easiest way to get access to, because you can find those on Spotify. And if you want to start planning now, that'll be Chimes of Midnight and Neverland. Again, I believe they're all on Spotify. So that's when we'll be doing our usual let's talk through and break it down. But up to that, things are a lot muddier. So we're just going to kind of talk about the general media, what was happening around the Wilderness Years.
And I wanted to try to provide context for everyone now, instead of at the end of the episode of the Rose next time being, hey, Rose, hold on 1 minute while we give our like 5 minute explanation of what we're about to do going forward.
Right. Seems to be
not a good come into our virtual house now. Let us make you sit and wait moment.
That's fair. That's fair. And we have more plans after all that too. So
we're not going to talk about those though. That's where we get back into no spoilers.
Right. But I'm very excited.
So thank you everyone for coming with us. And I know the last bit of Doctor Who is a little bit longer since we've gotten into our mini break run, but we feel the changes in media and format make it still feel fresh for us. And we also love McCoy, so it didn't really count as anything.
Yeah, McCoy, I mean, it's very, very old, and also, frankly, I love the Eighth Doctor Big Finish stuff, so that's not going to be a chore either.
Yeah. All right. So be seeing you.
Yeah, talk to you later.